Every revolution starts in the minds of the people. Arm yourself for the war of ideas. Take back your life. Take back your liberty. Tom Mullen Talks Freedom.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Tom Mullen Talks Freedom. Just a little note on the podcast. As you can see, I am, well, as some of you can see who are not listening on Apple Podcasts or some other audio-only device, I am broadcasting in video. I've been giving this a lot of thought and want to find a way to provide video content both for my interviews and my solo podcasts. I have an interesting dilemma in that I live in a house that was built in 1880. I actually live on a small 5-acre farm with chickens, and I love this house. It's wonderful. I wish I could pick it up and move it to some deep red state where I would still disagree with a lot of people's policies, but I'd like them a lot better than New York. But in any case, having a house built in 1880 is a wonderful thing for a lot of reasons, but not for doing a video webcast, because there is no good place in this whole house where I don't have natural light coming in or a large space in which to broadcast. The house is almost 3,000 square feet, and there isn't a room in here that's under or over about 10 by 20. So there's all kinds of little rooms. And anyway, so enough about that. I'm going to keep working on video quality. I used to use one of the fake backgrounds to do the video casts, and it didn't work. It makes you look ghosty, like Max Headroom or something. You're getting the real me here, and that's really my part of my house, like literally the best place to do this, even though there's a chair and a lamp behind me and a corner, which nobody else would do. But any other angle in any other spot in this house, I get part of a window from outside with too much natural light and all kinds of other things. So if you're a producer and you have some suggestions or some kind of proposal to work with me, then message me offline, online, whatever you want to call it, and I'll be happy to talk to you. So I wanted to say some more about the Libertarian National Convention. I wrote about this last Tuesday and about both the reaction to Trump and selecting Chase Oliver as the nominee, which I was very disappointed in. It's now 20 years since there's been a Libertarian candidate for president that I could be excited about, Michael Bodnarik. And I'll give you a little brief history. I was so apolitical at the turn of this century that I had never heard the word libertarian, as far as I know, or if I heard it, it just went in one ear and out the other. I never registered the idea of libertarian. So when there was the controversy with the Bush-Gore election, it had gone to the Supreme Court and lots of people were talking about it, talking about their views, I would join in from time to time. And a coworker approached me and he said, "Can I ask you a question? What would you say is your political views, or what are your political views?" I can't remember how he put the question. And I basically said something to the effect of, "I'm very against war. I think war is a scam. I think these wars don't do us any good." Now, this is before 9/11 and before the war on terror began. Okay. This is when Bush had just run on a humble foreign policy, something that I was glad to hear, but I also was telling people before 9/11, if you don't think we're going to war with Iraq after that campaign, then you haven't been listening. So anyway, this guy asked me what my views are, and I say, "I'm completely anti-war, everything I just said, but I don't think the government should have anything to do with business and regulating it or trying to help businesses or help working people. I think they should just stay completely out of it." And he said, "Oh, you're a libertarian." I said, "I am. What's that?" And that's the first time I heard the word. Now, during the 1990s, I had listened to some of the presidential debates. I voted for Ross Perot in the two elections in the 1990s. I didn't vote in 2000 at all. And I didn't vote for Perot because I had no idea why he was against NAFTA or what NAFTA even was at the time, because I just didn't care. And I should have cared, but I didn't. But I remembered watching the debates and him pulling out the charts and talking about spending and how this is not sustainable. So that I like that. And it seemed to me, I knew I didn't like Bush and I knew I didn't like Clinton. I probably actually preferred Clinton because I think that after Clinton won that election, I remember talking to a friend. Now, you've got to remember, this is 32 years ago, and saying, look, and my friend's a Republican, still is a Republican to this day. I said, look, this is not so bad. The other Bush, who knows what war he was going to get us into next. Remember, he not only had just gotten us in the first Gulf War, but he almost canceled the Buffalo Bills' first Super Bowl, which would have been even more inexcusable. I didn't want Bush, and I thought Perot is better, and I don't like either one of these parties, but Clinton was at least presenting himself as a business-friendly Democrat, not some communist like even Jimmy Carter sounded like at times. And we had just had a long run of Republican presidents. And it was almost like, again, my political knowledge was very superficial at the time. It was almost to me like the Democrats had learned their lesson. And having grown up in New York, I had always been fed a lot of bias against the Republicans. And given the fact that Bush just took us to an unnecessary war, that kind of confirmed that to me at the time. So I was okay with Clinton being elected. But anyway, this guy, this coworker, tells me you're a libertarian, and he starts pulling magazines out of his desk drawer. And I think it was like the Detroit Free Press or something, American Free Press. I can't remember. This is when there were magazines, okay? Because the internet was not what it is today by any stretch. And I thought, I'm going to look into this. And there was an internet. And I was, back then, I was like the most techie non-coder in any room at any given time. I could use Office. I could use the programs together the way they were designed to be used together. And I used to actually design databases. And what is it? Access. Yeah. I designed some Access databases that were actually used by the companies I worked for. In any case, I started looking into it. And I said, the Libertarian Party. Now, the other thing I should say before this is that the only other thing that I had done politically was I got curious in the so-called Founding Fathers during the 90s, and I grabbed that book that's actually put out by the Library of Congress, which, by the way, is missing some of the more important anti-state writings by Jefferson. But I don't know if I read every letter, but I read an awful lot of Jefferson's writing in that book. And then, of course, he was referring to Hamilton. I got Hamilton's writings. And I read those, too. And I said, boy, oh, boy, things are not anywhere near what these, at least that Jefferson said they should be. They're a lot closer to what Hamilton described in his writing. And so there was my knowledge base. And I had also taken a course in college that compared Rousseau to John Locke. And I remember being, at the time, I said, boy, I really like what this Locke is putting out, not so much Rousseau. And then, of course, I forgot all about it until I read this Jefferson book, and he kept mentioning John Locke as one of the three greatest men who ever lived, along with Francis Bacon and Isaac Newton. Politically, he was the greatest man who ever lived as far as Jefferson was concerned. He had Isaac Newton in there because he considered himself a scientist and thought science was a great thing. And then he had Bacon in there because Bacon also was science and education. One of the things I don't like about the inclusion of Bacon by Jefferson is I worry that he actually likes the idea of Bensalem and Bacon's New Atlantis, where the academics run everything. Jefferson had a lot of great instincts, and he had some bad ones too. This whole education thing, of course, was terrible. Intention, but terrible. He actually said near the end of his life, and this is in at least one of my books and several of my articles, that, hey, if we're going to have this tax-funded state institution, we better make sure we're teaching the right principles. And if you want to understand American liberty and natural rights, then you got to read John Locke's Second Treatise. And then also he mentioned Algernon Sidney's Discourses on Government. That second one was really written for the same purpose as Locke's first treatise, which was to debunk the divine right of kings, specifically as written by a man named Robert Filmer. I don't know how long I've been speaking here, but I still haven't gotten to the Libertarian Convention, but bear with me, I'm getting there. In any case, Jefferson wanted to make sure that since we have this state-funded institution, that we brainwash people as libertarians, or what we would call libertarians today, people who believe what John Locke did. And of course, that was a terrible idea, because as soon as you take over the institution, you can start brainwashing people for something else, which is exactly what the University of Virginia does today. And they've torn down statues of, I'm not sure, maybe Jefferson's next. I'm not sure if they've torn his down. I think they actually did take down something there. But in any case, so there was good and bad to Jefferson. He was a lot better when he was on the outside throwing bombs than he was in office, especially in that second term, if you're a libertarian. So in any case, here I am. I find out about the Libertarian Party. I go to their website, all right? And I thought, oh my gosh, these guys, I 100% agree with what I've just found on this website. I can't believe it. There's actually a party that I agree with, and I'm going to join it. And I didn't want a chance of winning anything. And so I became a libertarian, small L and large L. I guess I was a small L libertarian before that, but I didn't know it. Someone else had to tell me. Okay, so then along comes the 2004 presidential election. And I didn't pay any attention to the nominating process, but all of a sudden I became aware we got a candidate, and his name is Michael Bodnarik. And oh my God, was he awesome. This guy was a powerful speaker. He makes Trump and Biden look like babbling idiots. They do that on their own. But if you listen, go Google one speech by the late, unfortunately, and great Michael Bodnarik on just about anything. And you'll find out, you know, the kind of person that we should have as a leader. And I was just absolutely into it. I thought, I'm behind this. What a great thing. We got a party. I love the candidate. I love the message. I love the messaging. And I was real happy with that. I didn't have any high hopes for it. And right around 2004, in fact, I moved to Florida from Buffalo, New York, a suburb of Buffalo, New York, in August of 2004, actually the weekend of July 31st, something like that. So it was right before the election, and then I get down to Florida, and I've got a lot going on, and spent 10 years in Florida. It was economically phenomenal for me, and that's why I went and had to move back here to Western New York 10 years later, which is 10 years ago, for family considerations, just both parents and a sister who were very ill or in need of help. My mother, not so much. My mother is still with us. 91 years old and physically just a marvel. But in any case, so I had to come back here. But over the next, after 2004, the next presidential nominee for the Libertarian Party was Bob Barr. And I thought, oh my gosh. And at the same time, Ron Paul came along. And I had never heard of Ron Paul. Again, even though I'm a libertarian, I'm still not spending significant time on politics. And I had no idea about the Mises Institute or Ron Paul. I knew about Reason Magazine and the Cato Institute, and I didn't subscribe to it or pay that much attention. But along one day, my wife came home from work in 2007, and she says, did you hear there's a libertarian running for president? And having heard this before by this time, I even heard this about Bob Barr, I said, excuse me, woman, sit down next to me here at the computer and I'll show you how naive you are. And so I looked into this Ron Paul guy with the intention of debunking him as any kind of a libertarian. And oh my gosh, same thing that happened to me in 2002 or whenever it was, I finally got to the Libertarian Party website. Same thing with Ron Paul. And then I started looking for him, watching the debates, Googling his speeches, saw the Rudy Giuliani moment. I can't remember if it was, I don't think I saw, I didn't see that live, So I might have seen that right after it happened. In fact, after it happened, that might have been, I think my wife had heard about Ron Paul on NPR. So it turns out he's the real thing. And I thought, you know what? I can't believe this guy is on national television saying all the things that I believe. I was astounded because, of course, Michael Bodnarik never got on national television, or if he did, very briefly, maybe C-SPAN. But you weren't going to see, of course, Michael Bodnarik in a national debate, even though he would have won it, even if you gave him a whole fifth of whiskey before he went on stage because he was so much better. But, of course, so did Ron Paul. Hands down, won every debate. What was great about Ron Paul, too, while I'm reminiscing, is that very early on, the media stopped trying to gotcha Ron Paul. And it was, I think it was even before the famous question where the guy says, are you electable? And Ron Paul says, I don't know, I'm for abolishing the Department of Education. Our platform used to say that, doesn't say that anymore. We doubled the Department of Education. And Mr. Republican Robert Taft didn't even want us to be in NATO. And you're saying that means I'm not Republican? And that's the greatest line ever. He's, let me see if I get this straight. We need to borrow $10 billion from China and give it to Musharraf, a military dictator who overthrew an elected government. And then we're going to go to a war in Iraq and lose all these lives defending democracy. And just the place goes berserk. So I remember that one almost word for word. That's not exactly word for word, but that's a pretty close paraphrase. And he said some other things during that unbelievable answer. Just knock the head off the guy who asked it, which, and that guy admitted it later. He says, look, everyone gets mad at me for asking a snarky question. It's all how your candidate handles it. And your candidate knocked it over the fence. I don't know what you're mad about. I totally agree with him on that. Please ask some more snarky questions if we ever get a candidate like Ron Paul again. The Ron Paul thing, he did the candidacy twice. It got a lot of people together, even physically together in the same place, because he had Campaign for Liberty rallies. I spoke at many of those. My first book really was quite successful for an independently released book. And a lot of it had to do with the Campaign for Liberty events, where I got to promote them and do book signings. And in the meantime, after the Bob Barr debacle, we get Gary Johnson. Gary Johnson's 2012 campaign was, he was an okay Republican. He didn't lean quite as left in 2012 as he would in 2016. And he was nowhere near as goofy. And that was what really bothered me most about Gary Johnson in 2016. I don't know if it's that cannabis company that he started. He's sampling too much of the product, but he just seemed so goofy on so many things. And of course, he had terrible positions on some things. He wasn't really a libertarian. He was a pretty decent Republican, of which there are very few. And we had two of those campaigns where I'm like, come on, guys. I supported him. And I said, look, he would be a far better president than either Mitt Romney or Barack Obama or Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. And I stand by those statements. Of course, he would have been. But now it's three straight elections where the Libertarian Party has not even nominated a Libertarian. Okay, that's a bad thing, guys. And in 2020, as much as the Libertarians I most agree with, like Dave Smith and Tom Woods and the Mises people and that, decry the Joe Jorgensen campaign, and they're right about why they didn't like it. She is a libertarian. At least we did that. At least we nominated a libertarian for the Libertarian Party presidential nomination. So that was good. She was weak on lockdowns. Giving outdoor speeches with a mask is just horrific. But she's a libertarian. And she said a lot of good things. And she said she did that whole Black Lives Matter thing. And really, there's nothing libertarian or unlibertarian about. I think the thing that got everyone fired up was it's not good enough to be passively non-racist. We have to be actively anti-racist, something like that. And I think what people were fired up about is not that we should be racist, obviously, or should not like racism. It's that the entire anti-racism movement in 2020, 21st century America is completely disingenuous. racism is not a problem in America anymore. I know everyone's going to, some people are going to howl when I say it, but it's just a fact. No one is being denied a job because they're of their skin color. If anything, quite the opposite. No one is being kept out of a restaurant. Now, listen, racism was a problem back in the 1960s. It was a big problem. And it's really a shame that it was the communists who led the charge against it, because the solution to it could have been a lot better. It could have been a lot more free market. You got to remember, Jim Crow is anti-capitalist. Okay. The reason there were state and local discrimination laws, Jim Crow laws, is because the free market would have ended segregation. Okay. Restaurants and hotels weren't segregated before Jim Crow. So that's why they passed the law. They didn't like that. Okay. Yes, there were rank and file citizens who wanted that, but there were rank and file citizens and there were business owners, again, going back to the invisible hand, for maybe noble reasons and maybe completely selfish reasons, probably a combination of both, who wanted to serve both black and white and whatever, whoever else, customers. And that's why you had to have laws prohibiting it. Okay. And had the market been allowed to work in those jurisdictions, it is an absolute certainty that in the long run, the segregated establishments would have lost to the desegregated establishments. And I don't want to go on a long economic explanation of why that is, but it's just true. And maybe I'll do something else. If someone wants to hear that podcast, let me know. So anyway, racism was a real problem. Every culture was racist when you go back, but by the definition we use today. And I guess I should probably define that word, because a lot of people say it means hating somebody because of their race. I don't believe that's the true definition of racism. I think the definition of racism, or at least racial discrimination, which I used to think was the same thing, is that you judge all people to be the same based on their race. So when you go back to Donald Trump's famous or infamous speech, depending on whose side you're on, when he first started his campaign, the Mexicans aren't sending their best. They're rapists, they're murderers, they're this, they're that, the other thing. And I assume some are good people. That is, by definition, a not racist statement, because in order for it to be racist, he would have to assume that all Mexicans are the same, that they're the same because of their genetics, whatever makes them look in whatever the way they do. Like you just can't, nothing is true here anywhere. So that's my definition of racism, that you consider all people the same based on their race. And of course, I don't believe that's true. I think that different races do have certain proclivities. Maybe they have some inborn talents over others. I don't know. I really don't care, because I would rather just take them all as individuals and then, you know, make my judgments that way. And I think most people are like that. Most people just don't care about that. I can tell you, having been a business owner for most of my adult life, and having, when I wasn't an owner, I was a upper level manager versus a mid-level manager. And I've hired probably thousands of people over the course of the last almost 40 years. Because even when I was in college, I was running some telemarketing shifts, promoting the AAA Auto Club. This is going back to the mid 80s. Okay. And it never occurred to me to even, what I learned about hiring people is, a bad hire is so damaging that you have to make sure you get the best candidate. And the last thing in the world you're going to worry about is their race, their sex, whatever. Anything. All you're trying to do is, this person going to show up? Is this person going to perform? Is this person going to get along with everybody else, with the staff? Are they going to be a team player? Are they going to be whatever? All kinds of considerations that, and I'm telling you, I've made bad hires and I know what it costs. Thousands of dollars, at least, in a bad, depending on how long they stay. And these days, oh my goodness, when you put up a job on Indeed and you're looking at hundreds and hundreds of resumes, the amount of people who quit jobs after 3 months, it's just astounding, where you'll see somebody's job history after getting out of school, 3 months, quit, gap of 6 months, work somewhere 4 months, quit, gap of another 3 months, work somewhere for 8 months, quit. And you're just thinking, I can't afford to even take a chance on that person. So no, race is not a problem anymore. There is no such thing as the gender pay gap. There never has been. Thomas Sowell destroyed both of these 40 years ago with his writing, Civil Rights, Rhetoric, and Reality, came out, and I think it was 40 years ago today, or not this day, but this year. I think it's 1984. It's somewhere around there. And we're still hearing the same nonsense. And I've gone my whole professional career and I just didn't see it. And before I cared about politics, I didn't really hear about it. So I consider the whole race question promoted by people with bad intentions. I think the hard left is following Marcuse's advice to, as they were in the 60s, they just happen to have a good cause in the 60s, and side with oppressed groups, since you're never going to get your workers' revolution because capitalism treats workers too well. That's the bottom line. So anyway, that brings us to this year and the Libertarian Convention this year. And I'll talk about two things which I wrote about, but I'm going to say some things I didn't get to. You've only got so much space in a column, and mine go way longer than the average person reads. By the way, when I was writing for Washington Times all those years ago, they let me know, whatever you think is important, you got to get done in 400 words. Because if anyone has to scroll, that's like the old above the fold. So the fold in the newspaper used to be where people stopped reading. And now it's like after 400 words, they have to scroll. You lose like 60% of the people who read the first part. Yeah, that's true, people. So I know that my audience reads the whole article, but I'm a little long on purpose. I want to give my Substack readers some meat on the bone. So that's why I go long, and I still can't get to everything. But first, let me talk about the Libertarian Party. And Dave Smith has given a brief history on this. Everyone knows that the Mises Caucus just cleaned out everybody from a leadership position in 2022 who seemed to have this left-leaning bias. Of course, everyone's familiar with Nicholas Sarwark, who was the chair of the party. And he was replaced by Mises Caucus member Angela McArdle, who's doing a phenomenal job. And any comments I have about the Libertarian Convention don't apply to her. The fact that she got all those nationally known figures and all those eyes on the party was just something short of a miracle. It was awesome. It set the Libertarian Party up to have all these eyes on it, to be taken seriously, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, as usual, as they did in 2016, they completely blew it. And the first way they blew it was their treatment of Donald Trump. Now, y'all know that I didn't vote for Donald Trump. I don't support Donald Trump. I think he's a buffoon. I think he would have been preferable to Joe Biden had he won in 2020. I don't believe there would be a Ukraine war. Not because he wasn't going along with the arming of Ukraine, but I think what pushed Putin over the edge was the nonstop shelling of Donbass by Zelensky right before Putin invaded. Let me ask you something. What if there was someone out there who kept a log of every single thing you did every minute of the day? That would probably creep you out. Well, that's exactly what happens every time you go online. Your internet provider stores logs of every website you've ever visited and can legally sell this data to anyone. Worse yet, the government can obtain your data via bulk FISA order, even if you're not personally suspected of any crime. That's why I use ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN reroutes your internet connection through their secure servers so your internet provider can't see or log what you do online. Visit expressvpn.com/Mullen right now and find out how you can get 3 months for free. That's expressvpn.com/Mullen. Protect your data and get 3 months for free today.
Months before Putin invaded, really since Joe Biden took office, and with Biden in there, I'm not saying this is Biden personally, but with Biden in there, the State Department just basically ran unopposed, the most evil institution in the world. Everybody in the State Department should be fired. Everybody, right down to the janitor. Maybe you leave the janitor in there, but you have him followed for a while. Make sure he's not spying for all the people you just let go. So they ran foreign policy the way they wanted to, the way they mostly did when Donald Trump was in there, but he did check them a little, because when it comes right down to that, these people will not risk committing a crime like not following the president's orders if he gets around to writing them, which Donald Trump often did not. So they'll take any opportunity, of course, to go against what the president wishes, as long as they can get away with it. With Biden, it didn't matter. They didn't have a president who was opposed to their policies in any way. They green-lighted that shelling. If you think Zelensky wasn't shelling Donbass mercilessly, and I'm talking civilian neighborhoods, which I've seen footage of the damage, with State Department, U.S. State Department approval, then you don't know how the world works. That's how it works. And I don't think that would have happened with Trump in there, and he would have been talking more to Putin. And of course, you see how Washington, the swamp, whatever you want to call it, I call it the empire. You see how they turn around the one thing that was good about Trump, the whole reaching out to Russia, is something I've been saying since the mid-1990s. This is what I was criticizing Bill Clinton about before some of you listeners were probably born, and saying we're blowing this great opportunity. The Soviet Union's gone. Russia now could be a capitalist country. They could be a friend. They should be part of Europe. We should be just, and what, of course, the empire did was do everything they could to keep Russia down. First, they looted the place, and then they started expanding NATO so that Russia could never get back on its feet. Or they did get back on their feet, not with any help, and certainly despite the efforts of the Washington, D.C. empire. I actually wanted to see better relations with Russia long before, when Donald Trump was still going bankrupt in Atlantic City or wherever it was. And by the way, if I could go back in a time machine and tell people 30 years ago, listen, I just came back from the year 2024, and 90% of the American public believes that either Joe Biden or Donald Trump is the only man in the world that can save America, people would be rolling laughing. This is when Biden was younger than me and sounded at least as dumb as he does now. And Donald Trump had just gone bankrupt for like the fourth time. Nobody would have taken these people serious. The idea that's where we are now just shows you how dumb American politics has become. So anyway, Donald Trump comes to speak. And I don't mind that Donald Trump got boos, but it was the way he was booed, and it was the reason he was booed that made the Libertarian Party look, number one, not serious, number two, just like leftists on a college campus shouting down a conservative speaker. They just started booing even while he was talking. And had they, you know, given him polite applause, you know, polite applause can be as chilling, more chilling than boos. It's okay, these people are being polite to me, but they don't seem very enthusiastic. That can be more effective. And it's certainly more adult than just booing indiscriminately. Everything he said while he's talking, after he talked, it was just embarrassing. It made the Libertarian Party look childish. And I'll tell you, the people who were booing, and there were a lot of non-libertarian Trump supporters there, just came to hear the speech. And then there are a lot of libertarians like Mises Caucus people who, I don't know if they were doing the same thing. I suspect they weren't. But that wing of the party that are basically just progressive leftists who, for whatever reason, like to be called libertarian, and who were running the party before and have some left libertarian positions, they were just booing like college idiots when Charles Murray is speaking. So that was embarrassing. And they booed things that Trump said that were very good. Now, I'll say this one caveat, and I might have put this in my article, I can't remember, but Trump did not, his speech was written without any of his bad positions. As far as I can remember, he might have said one, and I can't remember what it was, that was very non-libertarian and that libertarians would very rightly boo, but he didn't say many. And I think it was only one. And the rest of it was all red meat for libertarians. You can think what you want about Trump. He has smart people around him, okay, that I don't necessarily agree with on everything, but I can't remember the guy's name. He wrote most of Trump's speeches before. He's definitely, he's the brains behind the Trump campaign, and he's a very smart guy. He's a lawyer, and I can't believe I can't remember his name, but you've seen him. And anyway, Trump was saying very libertarian things. People were booing while he said it. They were booing after he said them. That just looks dopey. And it was more that the feeling from the room was, oh, this is Donald Trump. He's a racist, so we have to boo him. That's what I got from watching the speech. I guarantee you that people who've never really known what the Libertarian Party is or even what libertarian is, that's what they got. Without a doubt. Are you kidding? Any conservative, any libertarian-ish conservative got that. And any libertarian-ish liberal got that. And the fact that the national media loved how the Libertarian Party received Trump should tell you that you're on the right, you're on the wrong side. Okay. I'm not saying you should cheer for him, but the way that he was reacted to after being invited there to speak, it did not do the Libertarian Party any favors. And the fact that every article by the leftist news loved it should tell you that. And the reason I say we don't want to please the left is because they have all the power right now. Let's face it. They have all the institutional power. If you want to challenge the present governmental societal infrastructure status quo, then you have to oppose the left. There is no right-wing institutions that there are to change. Okay, the so-called deep state is in bed with the Democrats. The so-called academia has always been on the left. The media is all left. Fox News, they're moving left. Okay, even though they're supposed to be right-wing, they're moderate at best. I wrote a whole book saying I don't consider libertarianism either right or left. I believe there's a third complete way of looking at the world. Libertarians believe the purpose of government is different than the right does and the left does. I don't see them anywhere on this so-called political spectrum unless you put the libertarians all on one side and conservatives and liberals in different spots on the other. Then maybe you can make a spectrum, but I think it's a three-dimensional picture. So anyway, receiving Donald Trump the way they did just made the Libertarian Party look terrible. They made him look irrelevant. Made him look like just another leftist subgroup whom no Democrat is going to vote for the Libertarian Party. Some Republicans might if they don't like Trump, don't like the MAGA nationalist mercantilist economic worldview. You might peel some Republicans off. You're never going to now, not a single one. In fact, I think some right-leaning libertarians are going to bolt and vote for Trump because of the way they received Trump at the rally. And again, there was a way to let him know we don't support you without behaving like leftist, childish rats. And that's what they did. And then they nominated Chase Oliver. So here's my problem with Chase Oliver. I'm actually going to defend some of his most controversial decisions because technically I believe he's right from a libertarian perspective on a lot of the things he said. the hormone therapy that they give to transgender children. So his official position on this is that he does not think that the transgender drugs should be illegal for children under 18. I'm sorry. He does believe that surgery, any removing of body parts or changing of body parts, should be illegal for children under 18. Okay. And I don't think, by the way, a 17-year-old is a child. But that's, you got to draw the line somewhere, and that's where the government draws it. In New York, I think the age of consent is actually 17. It's not a hard and fast rule. There's no immutable law of nature, but societies try to figure out there is some point before you're an adult where you don't have the experience, knowledge, the emotional development to really consent to certain things. And so we stumble around trying to find out where that is. And in most states, I think it's 18. So anyway, Oliver says if the parents and the doctor want these things, then I don't think the government should override those decisions. An anarcho-capitalist would say the same thing. We don't even want to have a government at all. And we want even things like theft, murder, assault, fraud handled by the market, by private institutions. So, of course, in an anarcho-capitalist society, those decisions are going to be the parents. And I'm going to say more on that in a minute, so don't freak out. Well, this is not a libertarian. I'm going to talk about that. Even in a minarchist society like the one we had in a lot of the 19th century, never perfect, of course, better before the Civil War, except for the slavery thing. It's a big problem. And then once we abolished slavery, the Republicans had taken over and the economy got a lot less libertarian, among other things. Anyway, part of the problem with the stuff that Oliver is not well-liked by the Mises Caucus on is that we don't live in a libertarian society, not even a minarchist society. Okay, we live basically in a soft fascist state ever since the New Deal that's run by unelected bureaucrats for the most part. You've got these elected leaders, and Congress basically still has the power of the purse, although they just rubber stamp what those bureaucrats want, or else they get shouted down like Thomas Massie. And you got the elected president who has way too much power, but basically, he goes along with those bureaucrats or they revolt against him. See Donald Trump. Now, Trump revolted against very little of what the bureaucracy, the deep state that runs foreign policy and the administrative state that runs domestic policy. And he certainly wasn't going to abolish any of that. But where he did push back in the very slightest of ways, they completely revolted. So that's the society we have. And we don't have property rights. As appalling as Jim Crow was, Titles 2 and 7 are very unlibertarian, and I think they should be abolished. Private business should have the right to say, you can't, I'm not serving you because you're black or you're gay or you're straight or you're white. They should have that right. I think the market would sort that out. The market had sorted that out before Jim Crow laws were put into place. So there was a time after slavery where restaurants were integrated and hotels were as well. Okay. So there's a long history there about how that happened. And no, it doesn't mean that every Southerner is a Klansman and a terrible person. That's a very complicated history about how it came to be that they started doing the Jim Crow thing. Again, subject for another day, but an unregulated free market, you won't have that. As soon as the first restaurant integrates, then you've got a competitive problem. Again, I don't want to go into the whole analysis there. We don't have a libertarian society. We don't have parental rights about a whole slew of things. So the question that confronts libertarians is, because we don't have a libertarian society, does that mean we never take libertarian positions until we get one? I tend to say no. Or does it mean we take the libertarian position wherever we can get it? So I think that also is a complicated question, because sometimes when you take the libertarian position in a vacuum, the issue rests in a landscape of very statist, very state-run, controlled environments, then sometimes you can get adverse results. I think that's where the right libertarians are coming from on the whole trans drug issue. It's, look, this would not be happening without a state in a free market. This is all kind of government driven. I don't think that's actually true. I think it's corporate driven. I think actually a lot of the money promoting this nonsense is coming from private money. Okay. And certainly you can't say that this would not happen. This would not happen in an anarcho-capitalist society at all. But you've got a planet full of 8 billion people. Some successful people are going to have some wacky ideas. Now, I do think that in a country of 8 billion people, there are legitimately some people who fit these diagnoses. Okay, it's a very small percentage. And probably who benefit from these drugs in some way. Don't tell me you can't find somebody, some kids among 8 billion that wouldn't be true for. But obviously we're seeing this. This is a social contagion that's being promoted. The fact that my daughter has several friends who say they're trans, okay, you should meet one person in your lifetime who says, and they should have the freedom to do whatever they want. Okay, and whether they're allowed to do that before they're 18, you could make an argument on both sides of that. And I guess the problem with Chase Oliver is he falls on the side with the empire, with the leftist progressive empire every time on every issue. And he doesn't just say, technically, I don't want the government overriding this. That part of it's fine. He talks about the issue as if this is a lot more widespread, as if there's a lot of people that this should apply to. And he just generally affirms the left in this hysteria at best, sinister, whatever, agenda at worst, okay? And I would go down the line with all of that. Open borders, you can make a case, a libertarian case for open borders. And you can make a libertarian case against open borders. And again, it comes down to this question of, if we had a real libertarian society, could we have open borders? Yeah, because we did, and we did. We didn't have completely open borders. One thing that I have an article about, that back when Dave Smith, I think, was debating at Spike Cohen on this issue, and they both, one of them stated, and they both went with the assumption that at some point before the 1870s, we had open borders. Now, we didn't have heavy regulation of immigration before that. We had none by the federal government, but the state governments used to regulate immigration. In fact, that's the argument that Jefferson and Madison made against the Alien and Sedition Acts, specifically against the Alien Act, that this is a state power. This is not a federal government power. By the way, and for anyone who hasn't read my writing about this, James Madison said that regulating immigration is a power nowhere delegated to the federal government in the Constitution. He wrote that. The guy who wrote the Constitution wrote that. Okay. He didn't say for another 10 years till 1808. They talked about that clause that some people point to, indicating that after 1808, it was a federal power. No, he said it's nowhere delegated. Okay. So you can go and find that article by me. Maybe I'll post it if I remember, but it was regulated by the states. In fact, the way the federal government got into the immigration business was over a lawsuit taken to the Supreme Court by a Chinese woman over the way that California was enforcing its immigration laws. So the state, it's Chai Lung versus Freeman, and I believe Freeman is the state regulation, state immigration officer who had, their policy was that Chinese people could come in, but if they suspected women were coming in for an immoral purpose, i.e. to be prostitutes, they could charge them like $75 a head or something to enter the country. There's a lot of money in those days. And this Chai Lung sued over this, maybe for being called a prostitute when she wasn't, maybe she was, I don't know, but she took it to court. And the Supreme Court discovered that this was a federal power in a decision that was at least as spurious as Roe versus Wade. At least, I think more so. I'm hyperbole. No, it was as high. Here's the problem. They made no effort to find where in the Constitution this was delegated. They basically just argued that this was not a federal power, that if it did belong to the states, it would be really bad, because one state could get the other ones in a war and all kinds of things. So it just must be a federal power. That's not an argument, okay? That's not how the Constitution works. We think it's in there because it would be bad if it weren't. You have to go in there and find where it's delegated, and it's not, okay? And neither is naturalization an indication that the government can regulate immigration, because obviously naturalization is about who can vote, who can become a citizen, and only a tiny fraction of people who cross the border become citizens, which is why the guy who wrote the naturalization clause and the 1808 clause and all the other words in the Constitution said that regulating immigration is a power nowhere delegated to the federal government. So anyway, Republicans made spurious arguments in support of that horrible Supreme Court decision for decades and decades, trying to say it was in there. And now they're in a box because the states that want to get involved, like Florida and Texas, have to make an even more ridiculous argument that it's some kind of invasion, which it is. The word invasion definitely means armed troops in the Constitution. Okay. If they had just been honest and just read a little history maybe and realized it was a state power, they could have been regulating this at the state level for generations, and they should bring a case about this. Somebody should bring a case about immigration to this supposedly constitutional court. I'm going to do a separate podcast on how this court is not anywhere near as great on the Constitution as people think it is, even people who like their decisions. Okay, so Chase Oliver, I think he's technically right on the whole parent versus the government, kids with drugs things. I think he thinks, though, that this is a great thing that these kids are getting these drugs, and I don't think it is. And the fact that we have to nominate somebody who's going to take this position that affirms the left in one of their more bizarre obsessions, elite deceptions, as Tom Woods calls them, is not good for the Libertarian Party. Same thing with his position on open borders, and of course abortion. That's another one. My position on abortion is you would put me in the so-called pro-choice camp. I don't want the government to regulate it, but I don't get there anywhere near the way the left does. I do think that you're ending a human life. All right. And one of the things for women listening, women, you got to start owning something. Women in the 21st century don't want to own anything. They just want to complain. So yes, I am granting that inside your own body, I will defer the power of life and death to you. It's a very complicated issue. It's the only one where one person is actually inside another. So property rights can get muddy. So I think it's a momentous decision. And in most cases, I would persuade women to not make it that decision if they wanted my opinion. But I don't want the government regulating it. Look, the government doesn't even do a good job on regulating murder of people outside the womb. They only make an arrest in about 60% of the cases. The highest percentage, by the way, that they have in any crime, in property crimes, it's 17%. So they only make an arrest in about 60% of the murders. And then at least 10% of those, they got the wrong guy, which they still try to prosecute whenever they have the opportunity, even if they know they have the wrong guy, withholding exculpatory evidence when they can get away with it. So the government doesn't even do a good job with murder as it is, but it's already on the books and they're already doing what they can. This isn't a criticism of every individual who works in the criminal justice system or as a cop. I'm just saying the government as a whole, because of all its perverse incentives and lack of accountability, does a crappy job with murder outside the womb. So I don't want to get them into abortion and have them do their terrible work there. I'm sure it'll be even worse. And yes, I know abortions used to be illegal, and I don't know that there were less of them. Maybe there were. I know there were a lot of tragedies with women trying to do this on the black market. The other thing I'll say to conservatives about that is that the thing we don't like about we libertarians and you, I'm not a conservative, the thing we both don't like about the progressives is this insatiable need to tell everybody how to live, how people they've never met in some state they'll never visit, and people they don't like, by the way, all these states where they're passing anti-abortion laws, those laws are supported by large majorities of the women in those states. And given any other moment, the people that are shrieking about those anti-abortion laws, they hate those people. They hate the women. They hate the men. All these people vote for Trump, and that means they hate them. So this missionary obsession with going and telling people in Montana how to run their state is something I abhor, and I think most conservatives abhor. But then we get to this issue. And yeah, I know the sanctity of life. It's not like there's no argument for this. But do you really care that much about what people are doing in the Bronx that you're going to go in there and regulate that, or in Massachusetts or California or some other liberal hellhole? You're going to go. I'm very also federalist on this. I don't think the federal government should have anything to say about this, neither passing a law that overrides state laws on abortion or going the other way and making it illegal. I'd like the federal government completely out of it. But again, Chase Oliver's on the left. He's on the progressive side of that. So he's with the progressives on the trans issues. He's with them on open borders. He's with them on abortion. He makes reasonable libertarian arguments for each one of those positions, completely ignores the other libertarian arguments that could be made against them. And it just isn't good for the party, because what does it say? Are we challenging the status quo at all by nominating this guy? No, of course not. We're just signaling. It's like we're begging for their approval. And that is not where I want to be with the Libertarian Party. Now, if the country looked different, I might be saying the same thing about right-wing positions, especially the tariffs and industrial policy and a host of other social issues that they might want to make into law that I don't agree with, okay? I'm looking for a libertarian society, something like we had in this country. Even after they started chipping away at it in the second half of the 19th century and certainly into the beginning of the 20th century with the progressive era, it was still far more libertarian than it is today. You used to be able to buy cocaine in the drugstore, and we certainly didn't have people overdosing on fentanyl, which nobody would do, by the way, if cocaine was legal and you could buy it in the drugstore like you used to be able to. The reason that we have fentanyl is because cocaine is illegal. They need to get more and more punch, more high into smaller and smaller delivery vehicles. And that's why fentanyl's around. And by the way, for everybody who disagrees with that position, tell me how many people who made a gin and tonic and went blind in our lifetimes. Okay. Nobody. All right. But that used to happen all the time. It was called bathtub gin, because alcohol was illegal during that period, and people made it and sold it on the black market, and it used to kill people. It used to make people blind. That doesn't happen anymore, not because government regulates it, but because it's on the free market. Businesses that are selling it, regardless of whether the government would regulate this, don't want their customers going blind, especially when their family can come back and sue them in the light of day. Anyway, I'm probably a little far afield. I guess what I'm saying is I'm, again, not enthusiastic about the libertarian candidate. And now it being 20 years since there was one that I was enthused about, I've run out of energy trying to fight the good fight and say, hey, come on, guys, even though he's not perfect, he's more libertarian than Trump or Biden. Yeah, that's true. That's true of Chase Oliver. He certainly is. Would he be a better president? Yeah. And let me say a few good things about him. He's well-spoken. He makes a much better presentation when not pandering to these leftist issues than Michael Rechtenwald did. I did not think Michael Rechtenwald was a good candidate. I told my wife that I was not excited about Michael Rechtenwald as a candidate, even before I knew who the hell Chase Oliver was. I had heard his name. I had no idea who he was. I had no idea what he had done. And I really didn't know why people didn't like him. I learned all this once he got into the convention and they started having these debates. I think Oliver makes a much better presentation than Recktenwald does. Some of his behavior since the convention really makes me think he's not cut out for this. I even question a little bit some of his mental health. Really, he's a brilliant guy. He's smarter than all the other candidates put together. And he's got the right positions. And he's a fervent anarcho-capitalist since his conversion from Marxism, his St. Paul moment on libertarianism. But he does not present well. He doesn't speak well. He doesn't look... He looks like a bookish old professor, and he sounds like one, and he's not inspiring. And Chase Oliver fits the suit when he's not wearing the rainbow flag. Fits the suit is something I said back in 2016 when I thought that the Libertarian Party should have nominated Austin Peterson. I love John McAfee, but nobody was going to make John McAfee their president. And, of course, nobody was going to make Austin Peterson or any Libertarian candidate their president, but they could imagine it with Austin Peterson. He fit the suit. He presented a conventional and conservative enough, not in the political sense, but in the personal sense, image that he didn't look goofy. He didn't look like a crazy man, John McAfee, which is what we all loved him for. And I'm so sorry he's not with us anymore. And I absolutely, you can go find my interview with John McAfee. It was probably the most enjoyable I've ever done. One of the more enjoyable. I got DiLorenzo on there, so I can't say that. I got lots of great ones. But in any case, I thought that they should have nominated Austin Peterson. He was way more libertarian than Gary Johnson. Yeah, you can find fault with a few of his somewhat little conservative positions, but not many. And geez, what a much better candidate he would have been than Gary Johnson and Bill Weld. And then 2020, we had candidates we could have put out there again that fit the suit better. Joe Jorgensen, nice lady, smart, a lot like Recktenwald, and a lot better looking than Recktenwald, obviously, but just another boring academic, uninspiring, did not stir anybody. I can't remember who the approved candidate was. It's slipping my mind. He's a good guy. We could have had him. Somebody that the average American could imagine being president. And between Chase Oliver and Michael Recktenwald, I lean towards Chase Oliver again. When he's not dressed in the rainbow flag, hugging a drag queen, that's all you're going to see from the right for the rest of the, if you hear anything about the Libertarian Party, that's what they're going to show. But when he comes out in a suit and tie and makes a speech, does a pretty good job. And he's great on foreign policy. Even here, if he talks about Israel and Gaza, he's with the left on that. But yeah, so is Dave Smith. So am I, right? I am a little less vocal about telling Israel how to handle this, because that's the real non-interventionist policy with me. But I understand why my good friends, Daniel McAdams, Dave Smith, and other hardcore libertarians want to decry it, because our money's going there. And I think Israel had a lot of this planned before the attack on October 7th, a lot like 9/11 for them. They had a plan, and that stupid move by Hamas, that immoral, stupid, strategically bad, atrocious, whatever, line up the superlatives, attack by Hamas, gave them the excuse they were looking for. We live in a world with governments, and when something like that happens, some heads are going to get stomped. And I think attacking the civilians is a bad look. It's tragic. I'm not surprised. Every war, civilians die, and that's how you know whether you should be. If you're worried about the civilians that are being killed in a war, then that tells you you shouldn't be in the war, because you should only be in a war when your survival or your liberty are truly at stake. And they never have been for the United States in my lifetime. And I'll say in the 20th century, yeah, World War II as well. another subject for another day. Chase Oliver's great on this. He's great on foreign policy. Look, government is supposedly exists to protect us from crimes, both from people who live around us and people in other countries. And of course, government instead commits them all. And what's the worst one they commit? It's mass murder. So if you're good on foreign policy, I can excuse an awful lot, put it that way. But we could have nominated somebody who is also good on foreign policy and didn't just look like he was crying out for a pat on the head from the progressive left. And instead, we did that. And it's largely from this left wing of the Libertarian Party, whom I thought we had expurgated. And apparently we haven't. I think Dave Smith said that after 2022, when he said he wasn't going to run for president, he thinks a lot of people left. And that would be unfortunate. I don't know if it's true or not. I know he believes it's true and he probably is right. And that's too bad. But just maybe I'll have a change of heart. I hope I do for some reason. I hope Chase gives me a reason to have a change of heart. But I just don't think you're going to hear me out there pushing the Libertarian candidate this year. It's been 12 straight years, 20. I don't know how you can make the count. Since 2008, I've been out there apologizing for some terrible candidate that the party nominated or at least compromised candidate. And I just don't have the energy to do it this time. So that's what I'll say about this. I hope that wasn't too long. And of course, I didn't look at the camera for almost any of this because I forgot that I was on video. So this will be a terrible video, but at least it'll be one. And anybody, as I said, who has any suggestions about making a better video in a 144-year-old house, you're welcome to reach out to me. All right, friends, that's going to do it for today. Just a few reminders to stop by TomMullenTalksFreedom.com/support and check out all the ways that you can support my efforts here, including joining my Patreon or my Substack. And if you haven't already, make sure that you go to itsthefedstupid.com to download a copy of my free ebook, It's the Fed Stupid. And as always, if you like the music you've heard here on Tom Mullen Talks Freedom, you can hear more at TomMullenSings.com. Thanks for listening.
The War of Ideas has only just begun. Arm yourself with the knowledge you need by heading to TomMullenTalksFreedom.com and subscribing to our email list. And remember, every revolution starts in the minds of the people.